did was to create a legend, what he called the legendarium or a mythology that he started to develop when he was 18, and he continued developing all his life. And the out of this came the Lord of the Rings and the Hobbit, but also came a whole series of descriptions of the world, descriptions of the imagination, descriptions of an ancient time that is also present. Now, the importance of looking at Tolkien's myth is that it is a myth of our time. It's a myth that has a lot to do with the experience of the breaking of things and the restoration of things. One of the things we will discover as we look at the way the Arthurian myth has developed is that at different stages, aspects at different times, different aspects of the mythos are developed to match different times. Tolkien's myth is a myth that's about the 20th and 21st century, and it's a sort of Tolkien is in his deepest sense is a mystical Christian, so there's a sense of a mystical Christian's sense of what's happening in the world. So that's where he's writing from. So I'm just going to read you this bit that's called this creation myth. It's called the Ainulindale, and it's called the Music of the Ainir. There was Eru the One, who in Arda is called Ilvuta. Arda is the world here. And he made first the Ainir of the Holy Ones. They were the offspring of his thoughts. They're like the archangels. And they were with him before aught else was made. And he spoke to them, propounding to them themes of music. And they sang before him, and he was glad. But for a long time, while they sang only each alone, or but few together, while the rest hearkened, for each comprehended only that part of the mind of Ilvuta from which he came. And in the understanding of their brethren, they grew but slowly. Yet ever as they listened, they came to deeper understanding and increased in unison and harmony. And it came to pass that Ilvuta called together all the Ainir and declared to them a mighty theme, unfolding to them things greater and more wonderful than he had yet revealed. And the glory of its beginning and the splendour of its end amazed the Ainir, so they bowed before Ilúvatar and were silent. Then Ilúvatar said to them, "Of the theme that I have declared to you, I will now that you make in harmony together a great music, and since I have kindled you with the flame imperishable, you will show forth your powers in adorning this theme, each with his or her own thoughts and devices, if you will. And I will sit and listen and be glad that through you great beauty has been wakened into song." Then the voices of the Ainir, like harps and lutes and pipes and trumpets and viols and organs, and like unto countless choirs singing with words, began to fashion the theme Viluvatar to a great music. And a sound arose of endless interchanging melodies, woven in harmony, that passed beyond hearing into the depths and into the heights, and all the places of the dwelling of Ilúvatar were filled to overflowing, and the music and the echo of the music went into the void, and it was not void. Never since have the Ainur made any music like to this music, though it has been said that a greater still shall be made before Ilúvatar by the choirs of the Ainir and the children of Ilúvatar after the end of days. Then the themes of Ilúvatar shall be played aright and shall take being in the moment of their utterance. For all shall then understand fully their intent in their part, and each shall know the comprehension of each. And Ilúvatar shall give to their thoughts the secret fire, being well pleased. Now Ilúvatar sat and listened, and for a great while it seemed good for him, for in the music there were no flaws. But as the theme progressed, it came to the heart of Melkor, who is one of the Ainur, to interweave matters of his own imagining that were not in accord with the theme of Ilúvatar. for he sought thereby to increase the power and glory of the part assigned to himself. To Melkor among the Anir had been given the greatest gifts of power and knowledge, and he had a share in all the gifts of his brethren. He had gone often into the void places seeking the imperishable flame, for the desire grew hot within him to bring into being things of his own. And it seemed to him that Ilúvatar took no thought for the void, and he was impatient of its emptiness. Yet he found not the fire, for it is with Ilúvatar. But being alone, he had begun to conceive thoughts of his own, unlike those of his brethren. Some of those thoughts he now wove into his music, and straightway discord arose about him. And many that sang near him grew despondent, and their thought was disturbed, and their music faltered. But some began to attune their music to his, rather than to the thought which they had at first. Then the discord of Melkor spread ever wider, and the melodies which had been heard before foundered in a sea of turbulent sound. But Ilúvatar sat and hearkened until it seemed that about his throne there was a great raging storm, as of dark waters that make war one upon another in an endless wrath that would not be assuaged. Then Ilúvatar arose, and the Anir perceived that he smiled, and he lifted up his left hand, and a new theme began amid the storm, like and yet unlike to the former theme, and it gathered power and had new beauty. But the discord of Melkor rose in uproar and contended with it, and again there was a war of sound more violent than before, until many of the Anir were dismayed and sang no longer, and Melkor had the mastery. And again Ilúvatar arose, and the Anir perceived his countenance was stern, and he lifted up his right hand, and behold, a third theme grew amid the confusion. And it was unlike the others, for it seemed at first soft and sweet, a mere rippling of gentle sounds in delicate melodies. But it could not be quenched, and it took to itself power and profundity. And it seemed at last that there were two music progressing at one time before the seat of Ilúvatar, and they were utterly at variance. The one was deep and wide and beautiful, but slow, and blended with an immeasurable sorrow, from which its beauty chiefly came. The other had now achieved an unity of its own, but it was loud and vain and endlessly repeated, and it had little harmony, but rather a clamorous unison, as of many trumpets braying upon a few notes. And it tried to drown the other music by the violence of its voice, but it seemed that its most triumphant notes were taken by the other and woven into its own solemn pattern. In the midst of his strife, whereat the halls of Ilúvatar shook, and the tremor ran out into the silences yet unmoved, Ilúvatar rose a third time, and his face was terrible to behold. And he raised up both his hands, and in one chord, deeper than the abyss, higher than the firmament, piercing as the light of the eye of Ilúvatar, the music ceased. Then Ilúvatar spoke, and he said, "Mighty are the Anir, and mightiest among them is Melkor. But he may know, and all the Anir, that I am Ilúvatar. These things that you have sung, I will show them forth, that you may see what you have done. And you, Melkor, shall see that no theme can be maybe played that has not its uttermost source in me, nor can any alter the music in my despite. For he that attempts this shall but prove my instrument in the devising of things more wonderful, which he himself has not imagined." Then the Anir were afraid, and they did not comprehend the words that were said to them, and Melkor was filled with shame, of which came secret anger. But Ilúvatar rose in splendour, and he went forth from the fair regions he had made from the Anir, and the Anir followed him. And when they were come into the void, Ilúvatar said to them, "Behold your music." And he showed to them a vision, giving to them a sight where before was only hearing. And they saw a new world made visible before them, and it was globed amid the void, and it was sustained therein, but it was not of it. And as they looked and wondered, the world began to unfold its history, and it seemed to them that it lived and grew. And when the Ainir had gazed for a while and was silent, Ilúvatar said again, "Behold your music, this is your minstrelsy, and each of you shall find contained herein the design I set before you, all these things which it may seem that he himself devised or added. And you, Melkor, shall discover that all the secret thoughts of your mind, and you will perceive they are just part of the whole and tributary to its glory." And many other things Ilúvatar spoke to the Ainir at this time. And because of their memory of his words and the knowledge that each has of the music that he himself has made, the Ainir know much of what is and was and is to come, and few things are unseen by them. Yet some things there are they cannot see, neither alone nor taking counsel together. For to none but himself has Ilúvatar revealed all that he has in store. And in every age there come forth things that are new and have no foretelling, for they do not proceed from the past. And so it was, as this vision of the world was played before them, the Ainir saw that it contained things they had not thought. And they saw with amazement the coming of the children of Ilúvatar, and the habitation that was prepared for them. And they perceived that they themselves, in the labour of their music, had been busy with the preparation of this dwelling, and yet knew not it had any purpose beyond its own beauty. For the children of Ilúvatar were conceived by him alone, and they came with the third theme, and they were not in the theme which Ilúvatar propounded at the beginning, and none of the Ainir had part in their making. Therefore when they beheld them, the more did they love them, being things other than themselves, strange and free, wherein they saw the mind of Ilúvatar reflected anew, and learned yet a little more of his wisdom, which had otherwise had been hidden, even from the Ainir. Now the children of Ilúvatar are the elves and men, the firstborn and the followers. And amid all the splendours of the world, its vast halls and spaces and its wheeling fires, Ilúvatar chose a place for their habitation in the deeps of time and in the midst of the innumerable stars. This habitation might seem a little thing to those who consider only the majesty of the Ainir and not their terrible sharpness. As who shall take the whole field of Arda for the foundation of a pillar, and so raise it until the cone of its summit were more bitter than a needle, or who consider only the immeasurable vastness of the world, which still the Ainir are shaping, and not the minute precision to which they shape all things. But when the Ainir had beheld this habitation in a vision, and seen the children of Ilúvatar arise therein, then many of the most mighty amongst them bent all their thought and their desire towards this place. The story goes on. But so this is the creation image that's right at the foundation of Tolkien's myth. And it's a myth that really has to do with the energy of creation itself. And with the, and you see this very powerful, very interesting thing of this song that arises, and the angels and archangels learning how to listen, learning how to speak to each other, learning how to participate in this great song. And then it's rather like the Christian myth of Lucifer, the brightest of these angels becomes encapsulated, becomes separated, and wants to make a music that is theirs alone. So this principle that we have in the Kabbalah of the Klippot, of separation and is shown very powerfully in the beginning of this myth. And what we see then is the dialogue really between this the part that wishes to be separate and the creative source. We see even the ideas of that separated part being gathered back into the great bundle of the living, gathered back into the enormous kind of harmony. And the Silmarillion, as it develops, gives a whole history and background to the stories that finally arise in the experience really of the book The Hobbit and the book The Lord of the Rings. And again, we will explore this over these years, because they explore very profoundly this sense of cooperation and separation. the One Ring itself, in the Lord of the Rings, is in itself the recursive circulation reiterating on itself. It is the spinning wheel that takes us back into itself. The whole experience of the ring of the One Ring, the principal quality it has, is to make us invisible, to make us separate, to make us alone. But it also to give us a sense of power in that. And it has this obsessive, compulsive, repetitive addictiveness in it. And so what we experience when we look at the One Ring is that temptation, to be separate, for our own light to be the only light, to avoid relationship, to come more and more deeply into separation. Now the final handout in your books, apart from the ones that are reference things, which are the Merlin stuff I talked about earlier, is one entitled Tolkien on the Tree. And if we look at that, it begins with an image that you find in the Lord of the Rings. And it's a point of the Lord of the Rings where the Fellowship are trying to go into something called the Mines of Moria. And they encounter this door, which has been created by the elves and the dwarves together. And you have this sense in the image of the door of these two pillars that are joined together. We've got a crown, hammer and an anvil, which represents the creative work, the crown of the king and the stars. And right in the center of the diagram, there is a star, which represents the Star of Hope. There is a secret word that is needed in order to enter the Mines of Moria. And the word is, the doorway is, they say, speak friend and enter. And there's a whole period of time where Gandalf is trying to guess some magical word. Whereas the word he simply needs is the word called the Melon, which is the Elvish word for friend. Now this word, friend, is right at the heart of the whole myth, really. It is about the generation of friendship, the generation of relationship. It begins, so this book begins with the Fellowship of the Ring. And one of the central things that he looks at, which it links really with the kind of she cards we'll be looking at, is the relationship between human beings and what he called and the elves. Now the elves are these kind of fairy beings, magical beings, that often in folklore are called cousins to human beings, that live alongside us and next to us. And would live in a different world, they have a different aspect, and there is a way in which the connection between human beings and elves represents that connection between solidity and fluidity, between the imaginal and the formed. And there is one of the interesting things about the She Pack is that the experience of the She Pack is that David Spangler, my friend, writes this, about this, creates the pack, and writes a couple of books about his relationship with the She. And David is in no sense a Tolkien scholar. He knows very, very little about Tolkien. But one of the central principles that his She contact talks to him about is the necessity for the development of a quality called Anwa, A-N-W-A. Anwa, A-N-W-A. And Anwa is is being in action. It is the flowing out of our song. I was always interested in it. It's an interesting word, and as I've been researching for this course and looking into Tolkien more deeply, I was amazed to discover that Tolkien created, as a linguist, a philologist, and he created two Elvish languages, and in one of them, which is High Elvish, there is indeed a word called Anwa. which I'm sure David has never seen, because it took me a lot of searching to find it. And Anwa means the presentation of our being as a gift to the world. So it means exactly what his contact presented to him. And he didn't know about it, so I wrote to him, and he was a bit blown away by it, really.
Do you sometimes get, in some non-linear way, that Tolkien was not just writing stuff down that he'd thought up?
But oh, no, completely.
Into a deepest
strata. No, I am convinced he was working with, imaginal beings, with inner contacts. And one of the things that in my experience happens, so if you work with this mythos, he himself turns up as an inner contact. So within these stories, and obviously if you look on the internet at the Tolkien's work, there was some people get very obsessed and a bit mad about it, but right at the heart of it there are these very powerful teachings, very powerful experiences. And if we look at what Tolkien himself writes about the nature of elves, and he wrote a wonderful essay called The Nature of Fairy Stories, which is it's worth reading if ever you have the opportunity to read it. It's not very long, but it's full of really profound stuff. So what he says about elves is they are a quite separate creation living in another mode. They appear to us in human form. For lack of a better word, they may be called spirits, daemons, inherent powers of the created world, deriving more directly and earlier in terrestrial history from the creating will of God. They are in fact non-incarnate minds or souls. Thus a tree fairy or a dryad is or was a minor spirit in the process of creation, or acts as an agent in making effective of the divine tree idea, or some part of it, or even of one particular example, for example, one particular tree. So he is saying that when he speaks about elves, he sees them as part of creation, teaching us, inspiring us, connecting with, enabling creation to come about. Now, if we look at the diagram beneath that. So I started to look at, okay, it's a massive myth, how do we even approach this, and so I started to look at, well, what are the key principal elements? If I start to look at Lord of the Rings, what are the things that stand out for me, and how do I place them on the tree? So in Malkuth, the first person I came to is the figure of Frodo. Now Frodo is the principal kind of hero figure of the Lord of the Rings. And he is something called a hobbit or a halfling. And the halflings are sort of beings that are very close to the earth. They're quite small. They're very British. They're not dramatic, they're very kind of, and part of what he felt he was doing was writing a mythology for Britain, which would have very strong English elements in it, because he's English, and so he's not writing from the Welsh traditions, he's writing out of the English traditions. And in a certain sense, the hobbits live in an idyllic English village. And they have all the problems of that. They have the insularity of that. They have the sort of laziness of that. They have but they also have this real quality of connection to the earth, connection to life. They have a grounded kind of solidity. And the hero's journey in Lord of the Rings is the journey of Frodo. There are these amazing figures you come across all the time, including the return of the lost King Aragorn. But the real journey, the deepest journey, is the journey of Frodo as he takes possession of the One Ring and eventually destroys that ring. But he does it in relationship. Now, one of the things that the first book is called The Fellowship of the Ring. And what happens to Frodo is the ring has been found by his uncle Bilbo, who is the character you find in the Hobbit book, and who discovers the ring in an underground cave in a mountain. And this ring has been owned by another hobbit, in fact, called Smeagol, who is Gollum, who becomes, through the distortions of the ring, becomes converted into this strange distorted figure called Gollum, who was obsessed with the ring and talks about my precious. The ring is my precious. I want my precious. And in a way, it's like a sort of a drug addict. The ring is a profound, obsessive object to Gollum. And Gollum, in fact, has a crucial role in the Lord of the Rings storyline, which we'll come to in a moment. What happens to, so, but Bilbo anyway finds this ring, this magical ring, takes it with him, doesn't know the history of it. It's actually this central thing that affects the whole of Middle Earth, but for him it's a nice ring, and he's this very grounded, very ordinary kind of figure, who can safely kind of hold the ring because he just wants to go home. After having been on adventures, he goes home, he lives happily. But there's a certain point where he has to hand over the ring to Frodo, because the ring itself is making him feel thin and stretched, because the nature of the ring is to make people invisible, to take them out, to diminish their substance, to take people out of creation. And Gandalf, who's the wizard figure and who is one of the great guiding figures in the book, kind of helps Bilbo to give the ring to Frodo. And Frodo, Frodo's going to go off on his own, but Gandalf thinks this is unwise, so he takes with him Samwise, who is a friend and a gardener, and then two other hobbits come with him, and they go off on an adventure. Pursued by these figures called the Black Riders, which we'll come to in a moment. And one of the crucial parts of the adventure is they meet a group of elves in a wood, and a figure among the elves called Gildor Inglorion, who is like a kind of initiator. And Frodo, because he has been very interested in the elves, has studied Elvish and speaks Elvish to him. And the Gildor Inglorion is so impressed with Frodo, he makes him an elf friend. So he creates a relationship between Frodo and the elves. And as the journey continues, see, so Gildor we see really in Yesod, because he is this imaginal figure who in a way brings Frodo into this imaginal kind of territory. There then are two other figures that we meet. One is Gimli the dwarf, who is a maker and a shaper and a warrior. And then Legolas, who is a forest elf. And these, in a certain sense, represent the qualities of Hod and Netzach. And then the next figure they meet is Aragorn, who at that point is called Strider, and who is a sort of rather disreputable-looking old tramp, but who is the lost king of Gondor. And these figures, the hobbits, Legolas, Gimli and Aragorn, form what is called the Fellowship of the Ring. Because in this first book, what they discover is that this ring actually contains all the energy of Sauron, who is the demonic figure who is trying to dominate everybody. And there is a great council at a place called Rivendell, where they agree that the ring must be destroyed. The ring can only be destroyed by throwing into the cracks of Mount Doom, which is deep in the land of Mordor, deep in the place of evil. And there is a very powerful moment where everybody's wondering what to do. All the wise and powerful beings are frightened to pick up the ring because they know it will corrupt them, and that they might in turn become another Dark Lord. And there's a moment where Bilbo thinks it must be here, because Bilbo's also at this meeting, thinks it's because he found the ring, it ought to be him that does it. But Frodo speaks up and says no, because he knows that Bilbo hasn't the energy to do that. And he says, I do not know the way, I do not know what to do, but I will take the ring. And in a way, this is Frodo's acceptance of his deeper destiny, taking on the burden of transformation, deciding, yes, I will disrupt the spinning wheel. I do not know the way, I do not know how to go, but I accept this burden, I take it on freely of my own will. see, Aragorn and Gimli and Legolas and the Hobbits and Frodo, and in the first part of the journey also Gandalf, start to travel together. We then come into the part of the book called The Two Towers, where we then get set into a bigger part of history, where we discover on the one side there is a kingdom called Rohan, and another kingdom called Gondor, who have been the two kingdoms that have challenged the energies of darkness. And so this journey of the ring is also taken up into this sense of there is a great war between the light, between light and darkness. The third book, which is where everything gets resolved, the ring gets destroyed, is called The Return of the King, because the other bit of the way, because what we discover is that the Gondor has no king. The Denethor, who is the steward of Gondor, holds the throne of Gondor in trust for the king. And the king is linked to the land and is linked to the white tree of Gondor that is withered. And the return of the king will mean the return of the flowering tree, will mean the flowering of the land. And in this case, what happens is that so the ring does get destroyed. Aragorn is revealed as the king and is crowned in Gondor, and he enters into relationship with Arwen, who is one of the High Elves, who renounces her immortality to join together with Aragorn. So there is this marriage there is this return of sovereignty, a marriage between the human beings and elves, which renews the world. And then takes us, and then the final bit of the return of the king is the return into the west, to the blessed lands, to the place of Ilúvatar. And Frodo, we'll come back to Frodo in a moment, but Frodo, along with Galadriel and Gandalf and others, leave Middle-earth and go into the deep west to be with Ilúvatar. So that is the whole kind of journey of the book, and it's embedded in this much bigger kind of mythology. Now, if we look at the universe in which this operates, we turn over the page. So who are the figures that we find in this? So in Earth we find the Hobbits. We find then the next set of beings are the elves, and the elves themselves are divided into different categories. So there's the forest elves that Legolas is one of, who are in Netzach. There's the sea elves that you'd find in Yesod. There's the Noldor elves, who are the elves that make things, that are also connected to the dwarves that are in Hod. And we find the high elves in Tiferet. The human beings we find as the Rohirrim and Gondor. They're the warriors and those who build the civilization. And then there are the secret figures into art of the Dunedain. Now these are a special strain of human beings, descended from a place called Numenor, and Aragorn is the chief of the Dunedain. So these are the ones who retain connection with the sense of the creative fire, the imperishable light, and the sense of sovereignty. And at the top of the tree we find the Ilúvatar himself, which is the creative source. And then we find the Valar, who are the kind of archangels, and the Maia, who are the angels. So this is a sort of universe within. So you have human beings, we have hobbits, human beings, dwarves, elves, operating in this story. So that gives us a sense of the major characters that are operating in the myth. Now the contrast to that more balanced world, and if we turn over, is the distorted tree. And right at the top is Morgoth, who is also Melkor, who is the source of separation. So right at the top is Morgoth, who is also Melkor, who is the source of separation. and his lieutenants, one is called Ungoliant, who is seen as a spider that entangles and confuses everything. And these figures called Balrogs, who are figures of shadow and fire that are like dark angels. Morgoth's, if you like, regent on Earth is Sauron, who is the principal Dark Lord figure in the Lord of the Rings storyline. And where we have Gondor in the balanced tree, we have another tower of darkness called Minas Morgul, which is ruled by the Witch King of Angmar. And where we have the Rohirrim, the balanced warriors, we have the dark Numenoreans, we have human beings who are dedicated to the worship of separation. In place of the High Elves, we have the Ringwraiths, who are these creatures of shadow, human beings, whom Sauron has given rings to, who takes them out of the world and makes them into these shapes, these shadow shapes of horror. In place of the forest elves and the richness of the forest, we have a wood called a Mirkwood, which is the dark wood, the strangling wood, the wood where no life happens. In place of the beauty and the creative abilities of the dwarves and the Noldor, we have something called the Dwarga, the dark dwarves, the dwarves who live inside the earth and twist the energies of the earth. In place of the sea elves, we have the figures called the Haradim and the Corsairs of Umber, who are like piratical figures that parasitically prey on people. And in place of the grounded hobbits, who nurture and look after the world, we have these figures called orcs that are kind of distorted beings. So this, in a sense, is the shadow of the other tree. Now, in the very early teachings of Tolkien, he talks about the way in which human beings become joined with the elves, become, in effect, an elf friend. And there is in a book called The Unfinished Stories, there is a particular myth that talks about, well, how do you become an elf friend? And we have this figure who's called Elfwin. Well, Elfwin's an actual Anglo-Saxon word. It means friend of the elves. So you can make that up. That's a real thing. And the sense of becoming an elf friend or activating that is this longing towards the West. Now, certainly in Britain, the West takes us into the Atlantic. It takes us into the sense of immeasurable seas. It takes us also into the sense of the sea of stars. So it's that sense of the quest beyond the horizons. So that sort of longing for more, longing for magic, longing for beauty, longing for the place beyond the horizon is the beginning of the feeling of becoming an elf friend. Now in this particular story, Elfwin follows that urge and goes off on a ship, rather like Brendan the Navigator from the Irish stories, or like Taliesin in one of it, or Arthur in his ship, and goes off into the great sea, following the path of dreams, following the sense of the intuitions, following the actual dreams, and comes to an island called Tol Eressa, the lonely island in the midst of the sea, through which the far west, by being there, the far west can be seen. So when he comes into the west, he comes into this path of dreams, he comes to this island called Tol Eressa, he follows a path across the island, and he comes to a place that's called the Cottage of Lost Play. And this is guarded by a male elf and a female elf. And the Cottage of Lost Play is that place of the imaginal, that place of the childlike within us, the lost stories, the ability to be playful, to imagine, to remember. The stories that inspire us, the stories that take us further in towards the west, to the place of magic and beauty. And inside that cottage, there are two rooms. There is the Great Hall of Abundance, where people sit together and tell each other stories and talk about their lives. And then there is the other room, the room of fire and story, where you are given new stories, where you listen, sit at the foot of the storyteller and listen to the ever-burning fire and are shown new stories, new images, new possibilities. And where that takes Elfwyn to, and his journey, is a place called the Tower of the Pearl, where the sleeper can be found. And by entering the Tower of Pearl and entering the chamber of the sleeper, there is a great awakening in him, through which he enters the direct path, which shows him the place of the great lands, where the sun tree and the moon tree that exist intertwined together. So this is the place of the opposites in union, and to which he experiences the direct presence of Ilúvatar. So again, this is Tolkien describing the same path that we've looked at on the tree this weekend, in this very particular, very beautiful symbolism. And again, you can look at that story in the Book of Unfinished Tales, and by identifying with the figure of Elfwyn, follow the story, imagine that story. It will take you right into that same territory that we've been looking at in the tree.
Crazy.
haven't finished. So, to go a bit more deeply into these figures called the Ainur and this idea of the song and the imperishable flame. So we'll see these are the figures. The next tree has these figures of. These are his version of the archangels. Yeah. And so these figures are, so you have these figures, first of all, Orome, who is the Vala. These are called the Vala now, as the Ainur work with the earth, they become something called the Vala. So the Vala of earth is somebody called Orome, who communicates with us through dream. Okay, so I don't know where you are, Andy, but if we go over the page from the Great Lands, there is a page called Ilúvatar at the back. So not the beginning, it has Ilúvatar at the top, Orome at the bottom. Okay. So Orome is the archangel of earth, we could say, using Kabbalistic terminology, and who speaks to human beings in dreams. Ulmo is the archangel of the sea, and who speaks to us through the tides of our being. Yavanna is the green lady who is responsible for growth and the flowering of things. Aula is the creator of the energies of the mind and the great shaper of things. Varda is the goddess of light. Mandos is the judge and the sort of and the figure who holds clarity. Manwe is a great Jupiterian figure, lord of the winds and the airs, who's present everywhere, who blesses everybody. Niena is the lady of sadness, the grey lady who works with the sadness of duality and brings us into the place beyond duality. As we go beyond duality, we enter the conjoined experience of the creative source Ilúvatar, the sense of the song, and the sense of the imperishable flame. Mandos is about judgment. He is the judge. Mandos is the judge. Is that kind of Geburic energy of clarity? That judges these about whether they're balanced or not.
Manwe is the
brightest of the Vala, who is a great beneficent, the great creative generative of love. It's also seen. It's not like a Zeus figure. He's seen as being as high as connected to all the winds of the earth. So is ever present, and in all places.
Mm-hmm.
Ulmo is about the mind and creativity.
Oh,
Yes, we are, of course. No, no, but all of this, right, this is a blast through, right? All of this, we're going to actually work with these figures, right? So we're going to do this bit by bit, but right now I'm chucking it all at you, so there will be some resonance in you. You don't even have to remember it, but yeah, we will come back to it. And so finally what I want to do, just before we come to 5 o'clock, is go over on the tree Frodo's journey, because this is the actual journey that happens. So what happens is Frodo leaves. So we turn over, this is the part that with Mount Doom is at the top of this one. At the bottom is Frodo leaving the Shire. So in the beginning of the story, Frodo leaves the Shire, takes up the ring, and there goes off with the company. There's an encounter with the ring wraiths, with the Dark Riders, and he is wounded by a thing called the Morgul knife, which breaks off inside him. He then goes to Rivendell, where there is the meeting of the council. And in Rivendell, they make the oath about destroying the ring, and the Fellowship of the Ring is formed. He's healed superficially from his wound, but the tip of the Morgul dagger is still in his body. They go from there to the blessed wood of Lothlorien. And there they encounter Galadriel, who is the White Lady, who is the Lady of is a disciple of Varda, the Lady of Light, and who is a great figure of light and blessing. And there is a very powerful moment where they look into the pool. It is Galadriel's mirror, and Frodo offers the ring to Galadriel because of her beauty and power, and she has to work with her own desire to be powerful, to be effective, to destroy the Dark Lord, and passes the test. There is then a journey, which many things happen, but we come to a place called Amon Hen, the high place. And here we find a place where Frodo becomes visible to Sauron, the Dark Lord. And he places the ring upon his, he's trying to hide from one of Boromir, one of his companions, who is trying to take the ring from him. But in placing the ring upon his finger, and he sits in this place called Amon Hen, which is the seeing place, the great high place, and he becomes visible to the Dark Lord, and there is a moment where he has to exercise his will to return to take the ring off his finger. He has to choose to be able to do that. What then follows is the breaking of the Fellowship, and Frodo and Samwise go off on their own into the land, towards the land of Mordor, towards Mount Doom. And there's all kinds of battles and exciting things happening, but the real thing that happens is the journey towards the darkness, to the final destruction of the ring. Now, who helps them in that, and who helps guide them in that, is this figure of Sméagol, who is Gollum, who is the distorted form that possessed the ring. Then they have to undertake a journey through the marshes of the dead, where they experience the dead of old wars, of old battles, all the history, in a sense, that we have been describing, that goes back for aeons. They again come to a passageway called Cirith Ungol, where a great spider seizes Frodo and injects him with a paralyzing venom and captures him. And Samwise takes the ring, takes on the burden of the ring, thinks Frodo is dead, but discovers that he isn't, and eventually rescues Frodo. And together with Gollum has betrayed them to the spider, but they catch up with Gollum again, and Gollum is the only one that knows the way into Mordor. So Gollum guides them into Mordor, takes them to Mount Doom. And the Gollum and Sam together are at the cracks of Doom, the place of the great fire. And at this very moment, Frodo is about to throw the ring into the fire, and then changes his mind and places the ring upon his finger and claims the ring. And in that moment, Gollum, who is Sméagol, bites off Frodo's finger, grabs the ring and falls into the abyss. And one of the clever, powerful things about this story is that without Gollum, the quest fails. So there's much for us to explore in that. And then finally, we'll just go over the final bit of the page, to the last bit of the page. Because then we're left now with Frodo, because we're left with the ring, and the ring has fallen into the abyss, has been destroyed, Gollum with it. The Dark Lord is completely undone by that. But Frodo and Sam are left stranded in this massive volcano which is exploding around them on Mount Doom. And what then happens is Gwahi of the Great Eagle flies to them and picks them up and carries them back to Gondor, where they are received by Aragorn, who is now seen by all to be the returned king. And the experience is then the healing. So he's very ill, of course, but he is healed by the king, and then witnesses the return of the flowering tree to Gondor. He encounters Arwen, and he speaks about there through Arwen discovering the beauty of night, the beauty of darkness. And in a certain sense, Frodo at this point becomes the priest. He is present at the wedding of Arwen and Aragorn. And then he returns home, and he discovers that home has been distorted by a figure called Saruman, who's also in the book, who is a sort of a wizard who's fallen into darkness, and who is now called Sharky, and who's running a sort of mafia-like operation in the Shire, and Frodo and his companions rouse up the people of the Shire, the hobbits, to expel the mafia, in a sense, the Sharky and his mates. And there is this extraordinary moment in the book where they all want to kill Sharky, who is this really diminished wizard figure. And Frodo stops them, and Frodo's role in this, as he becomes the priest, he abandons the sword. He will never wear a sword again, he says. And what he does in this bit of the book is to spare the life of Sharky, because he was once great and noble and might be so again. And Sharky is sort of destroyed by that comment and says, "You have grown, Hobbit. I did not know you were so terrible." Sharky is then killed by one of his own disciples, against Frodo's will, of course. Frodo then writes the Red Book of Westmarch, which is the book of all these adventures, but inside him still is the wound from the Morgul knife. And while everybody else, Sam gets married, his friends prosper, he can no longer be at ease in Middle Earth. And so there is a moment at the end of this great, great age where the elves are returning to the Blessed West. And Arwen, who has forfeited her seat to return to the West because she's staying in Middle Earth with Aragorn, she gives her seat to Frodo. And they go together to a place called the Grey Havens. And he joins together with Galadriel and Gandalf on the Swan Ships, and they go together into the Blessed West. And that's where the story ends. It's very cool. Very cool.